Hello, and welcome to Switchblade Sisters, the podcast where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. Every week here on the podcast, we invite a new female filmmaker, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about their favorite genre film, maybe one that influenced their own work. I'm film critic Katie Walsh, and today we have actor, comedian, writer, producer, Janet Varney.
Hello!
Hello! And of course, JV Club host.
That's true.
Janet Varney.
On the Maximum Fun Network.
Yes.
Yes, indeed.
Cross promo.
I know. You've got to come on mine.
Yes. Oh, I would love to. Mm-hmm. So, you guys know who Janet is, but I'm just going to let us all know who Janet is. Janet Varney is an Emmy-nominated actor, comedian, writer, and producer. She most recently starred as the horrible Becca on FXX's You're the Worst, and she created, wrote, and stars in the IFC series Fortune Rookie. JV can also be heard on her podcast, The JV Club, as we mentioned, interviewing famous folks about their awkward teen years and as a sarcastic AI sorry on the sci-fi comedy podcast Voyage to the Stars. She fought dark forces opposite John C. McGinley on three seasons of IFC's Stand Against Evil and starred in seasons 1 and 3 of Burning Love, obsessed with Burning Love. In the animation world, she was the award-winning voice of Korra on Nickelodeon's critically acclaimed standout hit, The Legend of Korra. In addition to numerous guest roles in television and film, both in character and as herself, Janet co-created, co-wrote, and co-produced Neil's Puppet Dreams, a series featuring Neil Patrick Harris and his puppet-filled dreams, and can be seen on Geek & Sundry's Escape, which she hosted and produced. She's also the co-founder and co-director of SF Sketchfest, the San Francisco Comedy Festival, which is now in its 19th year, NBD.
Wake up, everyone who dozed off during that snore fest. Katie, no insult to you. No insult to you. That was a lot of factoids.
We got to get them all. There's a lot going on.
Boy. Boy.
Janet has chosen Richard Donner's 1985 medieval fantasy film, Lady Hawk.
That's right.
Janet.
Yes.
Why did you choose Lady Hawk?
The music?
Yes. We're going to talk about the music.
I honestly don't know. I never talk about this movie with anyone. So
today is a special treat.
It's a special treat. And yeah, when I was given sort of the choice of a genre movie to pick, it's alarming how quickly I thought of that movie.
Oh, yeah.
And then
I immediately
was like, oh, I better scan the list, thinking like, oh, I'm sure someone did it already, but not really knowing why I would logically think that. And then realizing that it hadn't been done and feeling like, oh, my God, this is such a great excuse to watch this movie. I haven't seen it in so many years.
Yeah, it's a blast. I was super happy to watch it. I'm going to describe Lady Hawk a little bit for those who haven't seen it. And if you haven't seen it, today's episode will contain spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. Like we always say, it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you want to pause this episode and watch it, now is your chance.
Great.
So, Lady Hawk, as I said, is a 1985 medieval fantasy film directed by Richard Donner, written by Edward Kamara, Michael Thomas, and Tom Mankiewicz. It stars a post-War Games, pre-Ferris Bueller.
Thank you for putting that in a chronological context.
It's
important.
I have no idea.
I have no idea where it falls. That's good. Okay. So
War Games was 83.
Post-War Games, pre-Ferris. That's what
you
said?
Yeah, Ferris was 88, and this movie's 85.
Great.
Matthew Broderick as Philippe Gaston, or Philippe the Mouse, a thief who escapes from the Bishop of Aquila's dungeon through the sewer right before he's due to be executed. He makes his way to an inn where he's captured by the bishop's guards, but he's rescued by a mysterious blonde man in black armor and his trusty hawk. His name is Etienne Navarre.
Mm-hmm.
He is Rucker Hauer. He's the former captain of the guard, and he wants Philippe to help him sneak back into the palace or the fortress to kill the bishop.
I need you to guide me into the city. Not for the life of my mother, even if I knew who she was.
You're the only one who has ever escaped from there.
It was chance, pure chance, a miracle, once in a lifetime. I fell down a hole and followed my nose.
But one night, Philippe narrowly escapes attack from a farmer with the help of a black wolf who's accompanied by a mysterious woman in a cloak. The mysterious woman is Michelle Pfeiffer.
Now, do you have the context for pre and post Rutger and Michelle?
I have. It is post Grease 2.
Okay.
And post Scarface.
Okay.
Which was significant to me because she looks so young in this film.
Yeah.
And in those movies, she's like very mature.
Yes.
Rucker Hauer, Blade Runner was in 1982. So it was after Blade Runner.
Okay. Okay.
Which
All
is interesting because he's kind of a bad guy in Blade Runner.
Right.
And Richard Donner wanted him to play the bad guy.
Oh, really?
He wanted him to play the captain of the guard,
uh-huh,
who he ultimately kills at the
end. Yeah.
He had cast Kurt Russell as Navarre.
My gosh. Okay.
And then like 10 days before they were supposed to start shooting, Kurt Russell dropped out. And
what a roller coaster.
I know. And Rucker Hauer had initially been like, I really want to play the Navarre role. And so then Richard Donner calls him up, is like, can you get here? And he drove, he had like a semi truck that he had turned into a mobile home, and he drove it from the Netherlands to Italy.
Okay.
And
first
parked
of all,
it outside of the studio, and Richard Donner was pissed. Okay. So anyway, we back to the synopsis. We are, so there's this woman with a wolf. There's a man with a hawk.
Mm-hmm.
What is the connection? There's a fight with the guards again, and the hawk gets injured, and Philippe takes the hawk to this priest's castle.
I was told to bring you this bird. It's been wounded.
Oh, good shot. Bring it in. We'll dine together.
We can't eat this bird.
Oh, God, is it Lent again already?
This is no ordinary hawk, Father. It belongs to a man named Navarre.
Mother of God. Bring it in quickly!
Ultimately, he finds out, he sees the young woman at night with a wound in the same place that the hawk is. Dun, dun, dun. Michelle Pfeiffer is a lady that turns into a bird.
That's right.
And Rucker Hauer is a man that turns into a wolf. But it's by day and by night, and they swap.
By day, Isabeau is the beautiful bird you brought to me. And by night, as you have already guessed, the voice of the wolf that we hear is the cry of Navarre.
Mm-hmm. It's a spell that a very wicked, black arts focused bishop.
Yes.
Holding true to the sort of idea, possibly from medieval periods and others, that somebody who has power and is supposed to be religious is actually, you know, perhaps the most corrupt. So this guy sort of calls, he's in love with Michelle Pfeiffer's character, and mm-hmm. he is so jealous of the love that she shares with Rucker Hauer's character that he makes a pact with the devil, essentially. And this spell is cast, and so she is, am I allowed to just jump in? I'm so enthusiastic about this. She is the hawk by day, and he's the wolf by night, and they never ever get to interact because the transition takes place. So it's this very cruel joke that
it's like you're together forever, but you can never actually be together.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they want to break the spell during a solar eclipse, which is a day without night and a night without day. So they ultimately break back into Aquila and break the spell just by sort of like looking at him. Like, I was like, what do they have to do? They have to confront him. So they both have to look at the bishop while they're in their human form.
That's clear to me.
Yeah.
I think if you want to see how passive love conquers all is, that's what it looks like. Two people who love each other looking at someone else like, see?
Right.
Love conquers all, everybody. That's what that is.
And then Rucker Hauer like throws a sword, kills the bishop.
Gotta throw that sword.
A lot of kissing at the end. And then, you know, like I was like, everyone's just like kissing each other. On, like Matthew Broderick kisses the priest. And then they like.
That's Richard Donner for you, I think. Yeah. There's a lot of comedy.
Lot of love.
He packed some comedy into this where there wouldn't have been if it were a different person, I think. And
I was gonna ask you when you first saw it, like, what's your relationship to it? Like, when you saw it as a kid, like, do you remember the first time you saw it? Or
I don't remember the first time I saw it, but I was definitely like many kids, I think maybe like all kids, if I liked something, I would just want to watch it over and over again. And I think, when I look back on movies that I was kind of obsessed with when I was younger than a teenager, I think like there are very few of them that are that hardcore romantic. Like this is very, very over the top sort of love conquers all.
Yeah.
And like this idea of the star-crossed lovers who aren't able to be together. I don't know that I responded so strongly to other things like that. But this movie I just loved. And I really do think I probably just stumbled upon it in the video store because it was, I mean, I don't think it's rated R or anything. My dad would just sort of turn me loose and be like, find something. And
and you were like, Lady Hawk.
And I was like,
yes.
Interesting. I just loved it. But I think Michelle Pfeiffer is so... She is a peculiarly beautiful woman in a very otherworldly way. And I think, you know, we can get into the sort of like feminism or lack thereof or whatever and the fact that she sort of literally the only woman in the movie, except for like one little thing you see in the background of a different scene. But she is the kind of actress that I do associate with this kind of ethereal, but also like a toughness. So she's, to me, she's believable, even though she's this tiny little creature. She's sort of believable as surviving in some way.
And she's very,
very
self-
little makeup. You know, they don't do much. So she just seems like she could transform into a bird. Whereas like if you told me, you know, if they were like, and Cameron Diaz as, I would be like, oh, no.
Well, apparently, I don't know who else was in the mix for the role, but apparently she self-taped and she had an unknown friend named Kevin Costner.
Oh my God.
Read the lines
so
with her.
Funny.
It was like prior to his breakout roles. But she didn't want to play a princess. Like she wanted to play, you know, and I think people had kind of said, oh, you're too pretty for certain roles.
Sure.
And which is believable.
Yeah.
I think she wanted to play something that was like not just a damsel, and I don't think this role is really a damsel
not
role
at all. Yeah,
and I like that she has sort of androgynous hair.
Yeah,
and...
I know it's great. It's just like a weird bedhead little boy messy hair.
Yeah, and I think that's why I was like surprised that it was after Scarface and Grease too, because she looks really young.
Yeah, she does.
I think they kind of make her look a little bit more boyish, and I like that she's like always just wearing like these huge like sack gowns.
Yeah, she's sort of like she's putting on Rucker Hauer, we assume.
Yeah, like
the clothes he was
yeah.
wearing, but now he's a wolf, so she's swimming. You're right, in these like giant cloaks and hoods and stuff like that.
I do appreciate that the film really takes the time to dive into the logistics of transforming into an animal.
That's right. You know what? But that's the thing that I love about it, and because I did rewatch it.
Yeah.
And there is a scene in it that still makes me cry, where because of the way they're positioned on this one particular day, because there's a mountain peak behind them,
when the sun hits. It is such a devastating
the sun
scene.
Hits this. The sun is hitting his fur. And it's sort of it's behind her. She's sort of backlit. And so it's coming past her and it's hitting him. And we see the transformation of them. And it's so not like, you know, Teen Wolf or American Werewolf in London or the Thriller video, where like the whole point is the special effects.
Mm-hmm.
It's all very kind of symbolic.
Yeah.
And it's that whole movie to me is both like adorably dated, but also weirdly timeless for some of the same actual reason, like for some of the same things. Like to me, that whole sequence seems so dated in the sense that it's like, hey, they did the best they could because this is, you know, this movie isn't about special effects and they just wanted to convey a feeling, but it's also clear that, you know, it's not overly sophisticated.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like seeing it now, to me, it super works.
Yeah.
It's just like this beautiful artistic series of shots.
All of the transformation sequences are really interesting because it is like close-ups of like a hawk's eye and a wing and someone falling and, you know, sunlight hitting and eyeballs changing. And it's like, it's not that body horror of transformation where it's like
and whiskers come out of your skin. Yeah.
Right. Were you a fan of the fantasy genre or like the medieval period?
Yeah. Not really. I mean, I feel like I like tried some Piers Anthony when I was young, but I think I was much more a sci-fi reader. Like, I loved Ray Bradbury a lot as a kid. And so, yeah, I wasn't into particularly, like, you know, if you'd asked me if I wanted to be, like, Madison and Splash versus any medieval princess, like Maid Marian or anything like that, I would have picked, you know, being a mermaid.
Right. Well, it's a difficult choice.
Yeah. And I think I also, in a lot of the medieval stuff, I really identified, and I would love to... I feel like there's something patty on the backy about being like, well, I identified with the boys in the movies. But that is what I identified with. Like, I grew up on, my dad loves the Pirates of Penzance movie that Kevin Kline is one of the stars of. And I loved him and what the policeman got to do so much more than the idea of like wearing a frilly white dress and singing high. That, you know, that's what I wanted to look like. I wanted to have the pirate boots and to have, you know, the sword and to have the white floofy shirt, which I guess you get as a man or a woman in certain areas, certain eras. But so, yeah, I wasn't like Miss Medieval.
Right. Well, it is tough because in those movies, and I grew up watching all those 90s Robin Hood, Musketeers, Man in the Iron Mask.
It's
I wanted to be Kiefer Sutherland.
Yeah.
In Three Musketeers. Like, I'm like, I don't care about being Maid Marian. She's stuck in some castle. But I mean, so you do have to find those moments of identification where you can kind of like get in if they're not being represented.
Yeah. But I think the idea of transforming into an animal and back, I think that was always something. Did you watch stuff like that where that appealed to you? Like, I remember when Wolf came out.
Mm-hmm.
I was like real into that too, weirdly, with Michelle Pfeiffer as well.
Yeah. yeah.
But like anything like that where someone transforms into an animal and back, there was this movie called Cat People that I saw on video, you know, and stuff like that I was very attracted to. I'm realizing that now. Like, it was probably more about
the animal
transformation than it was about anything else.
Yeah. And you also mentioned the score. So when we're going to take a quick break, when we come back, we're going to dive deep.
Great.
On the score.
I can't wait.
Hey, I'm Dan McCoy.
I'm Stuart Wellington.
And I'm Elliot Kalin. Together, we're The Flophouse,
a podcast where we watch a bad movie and then talk about it.
Movies like Space Hobos, Into the Outer Reaches of the Unknown and the Things That We Don't Know, the movie, and also Who's That Grandma?
Zazzle Zippers, Breakdown 2, and Backhanded Compliment.
Elvis is a Policeman.
Baby Crocodile and the Happy Twins.
Leftover Potatoes?
Station Wagon 3.
Herbie Goes to Hell.
New episodes available every other Saturday.
Available at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bye.
Bye.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. We are with Janet Varney, and we are talking about Lady Hawk. I don't know why I said it like that.
It's good. I like a musical title.
Yeah.
Whether it deserves it or not.
Appropriate.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about the score.
Great.
Which is bonkers.
Yeah.
I mean, what?
I feel like I've cycled through, did not remember it at all. Like, it made no impression on me as a child.
Mm-hmm.
So and then I remember like catching up on this movie, like being like, maybe it was on, I don't know, but like maybe 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
seeing some of it and being so horrified by the music that I was like, what did they do? They ruined this movie. How did I not remember this? To now, fast forward to today, I watch it and I'm like, this is great.
Yeah. So the score was written by a guy named Andrew Powell, who only did one other movie score.
Okay.
Called Rocket Gibraltar.
All right.
But he's like he works a lot. He's like a composer, arranger, and he was working with this group called the Alan Parsons Project.
Yes.
Apparently Richard Donner, when he was location scouting, was listening to the Alan Parsons Project, and he like could not get that out of his mind.
Oh, no.
So, of
it's
course,
so this personal. So this is like a personal inside reason for this absurd score.
Yeah. And so, and then, of course, today I was listening to get in the zone. I was listening to the Alan Parsons Project, their like 1982 album.
Oh, my
and it
God.
Is like, it is exactly this vibe. But the other fun fact about Andrew Powell is that he produced Kate Bush's first two albums.
Interesting.
So,
I love that.
Yeah, he produced The Kick Inside, which has Wuthering Heights on
it,
which everyone knows Wuthering Heights because it's
come on, guys.
Kate Bush in the red outfit, like doing a crazy dance in a field.
Dee 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 dee. Yeah.
Out on the wide, windy moors, we roll and fall in green.
Also, that video, I mean, like, that vibe of that video is totally this movie, which is, like, ancient but modern.
Yeah.
And, like,
sexy, misty, what's happening?
We're on the moors. It's, like, witchy.
My heart is broken and I must sing about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And,
you're
like, where you're like, this is weird, but I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. It came right back around.
But it's interesting because I feel like, you know, we say, oh, you know, this is a Richard Donner film and, like, you know, Vittorio Storaro shot it. But I really feel like as I was researching the film, the driving force behind this movie was Lauren Shuler
Donner,
who
Interesting.
Is married to Richard Donner.
Okay.
And they met and fell in love on this movie.
Really?
Yes.
And Wait, what does she do?
She's the producer.
She's a producer, yeah.
So she produced Mr. Mom, one of my favorite
Great
movies
movie.
From childhood.
Great movie.
Another movie I watch on VHS all the time. Why? I don't know. I was like 8 years old. What yeah. was I doing? It was like the only movie we had.
Yeah. So, I mean, listen, things that have like a comedy and a heart to them, yes. it's hard not to just yeah. like always want to watch
And that's
it,
kind of Richard Donner, and that's obviously her movies too, but she got the option for the script. From Edward Kamara, who was one of the screenwriters, and then she spent years trying to like get it into production. She convinced Richard Donner to direct it, and then they fell in love.
That's a wonderful story.
Yeah, they got married in 1985, and they're still married.
Unfortunately, she was could only produce the movie by night, and he could only direct the movie by day. And so she would see, it would be like they would have the slate, and it would be like just as it was clicking to end the last scene as the sun was going down, he would turn into a Lethal Weapon. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Superman. In your career, I mean, you've done a lot of stuff where you've started things and you've done creative stuff on your own, like sort of like not waiting for someone to hand you something, you doing creative projects with your friends. I mean, I was thinking about that when I was thinking about Lauren Shuler Donner and her producing things and her career. And I mean, how you know what's been your ethos in sort of like starting your career and you know getting your projects going?
Well, I think one of the things that actually it's funny if we're going to draw any comparisons between my meager career and this movie, I do think the idea of like it's even when I started my podcast, at the time that was like 7 years ago or so, and there were great podcasts already. I mean, I laugh because I remember thinking then, oh, but everybody already has a podcast.
Oh,
and
man,
that
yeah.
just meant five people did instead of like literally everyone.
Yes.
Not literally. But I think I very much at that time wanted to be able to be really sincere. And it's funny that I finally ended up on Maximum Fun because that's something that Jesse has always like been very forward about. And I always tell him how much I loved, like 12 years ago, maybe more, he had these little buttons that said the new sincerity that had two kittens hugging.
Uh-huh.
And the idea being like, no, you like it because you like it. You don't like it because you're snarky and you're being ironic about it. Yes, mm-hmm. there's a place for that.
Mm-hmm.
But also like, how about you just gushy, mushy love something and you're also a comedian who makes fun of stuff? Like, can't those things coexist? Mm-hmm. And I think that was at a phase in my life where maybe I felt like I was like what I was exposed to or what I was around a lot was maybe a little too snarky for what I was feeling. So the idea of being able to mix comedy and heart, I think that comes from like loving movies like this where, you know, there are very few movies that I love that don't have a real sense of humor to them, that don't take themselves so seriously, because it gives you permission and that's why I think things like Guardians of the Galaxy succeed so well now, is like you have the permission to recognize when something is preposterous. But because the whole movie has a spirit of like self-awareness or just joyful silliness, you can sort of accept and move past all of these things that maybe don't make sense or they're just, you know, so absurd. But when a movie takes itself super seriously, when anything takes itself so seriously, that's when it's like begging you to find the faults in mm-hmm. a sense. You know, it better be real good because you're going to have a lot of downtime to sort mm-hmm. of go, I don't know, you're being very like, you know, strum and drong about this moment in this movie, but like, does this even make sense? Because if he went back in time, how is he not, like, you know, you sort
right.
of start deconstructing it. So I think if you can leave room for humor, but also leave room for vulnerability, mm-hmm. then that's a really great piece of work. And I think that's what I'm drawn to, and that's what I'm drawn to creating. And so that's something that, you know, can be hard because if you're working and this goes in sort of any business where you feel like maybe you're not represented the same way another group is, and you don't see as many people pushing the boundaries or what have you. And that's definitely happening less for women nowadays. Like mm-hmm. there's a lot more equality on the way and happening and present. But to be able to just go, okay, not only do I want to start this new thing, but I want to start this new thing that feels like a very vulnerable thing to do because it's from the heart and I'm not protecting myself and I'm not, you know, I'm just kind of putting it all out there. I think that's a different kind of courage. And I just admire people so much who do that, like the Maria Bamfords of the world, mm-hmm. for example.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Like, I was looking at your Twitter and it's like, it's very enthusiastic and celebratory and that can be, you know, and I think that even in like fandom worlds now, it's like, it's not about loving things. It's about not liking certain things, which is so frustrating.
Right. Yeah.
Especially as a creator or even as a fan or a critic or anybody who, you know, is in this world. It's like constant negativity.
Yeah. That's a hard thing. I mean, that's a conversation, obviously, that's ongoing about things like social media.
And, right.
That's obviously like a very, very fair criticism. And it's kind of the reason why I haven't really engaged negatively, even though that's something that I struggle with. I mean, I struggle with not being more political on social media, mm-hmm. but I can't do it. I mean, I physically can't take it. I can't take that much righteous indignation, even though I certainly feel it and I certainly act upon it in other ways. I have friends who are extremely loud on social media and in trying to, you know, amass a bunch of people to make good things happen and all of that. And I respect and appreciate that so much. And I'm so glad that there are people doing it. But that's something that's I think, an ongoing question that we're asking ourselves in this particular place and time, because if you can either feel the responsibility of like, no, I need to be very loud because I need people to hopefully understand that I stand for something, or, you know, maybe I'll change some minds, versus like, is there some way for me to do that that doesn't encourage trolls, or that or that doesn't feel like I'm preaching to the choir, or do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of an ongoing thing. You know, where do you put what? What's your output? Where is your art? What kinds of art are you putting out, and where? And what are the desired effects? And what can you handle as an artist before you would just like crumple up into like a dry leaf and blow away and not be able to do anything anymore? You know,
right? And as someone who's like constantly creating new stuff, whether you're like doing a podcast or a show or like acting on a show or like whatever, I mean, how do you like keep those? I imagine that in order to keep going, like in the landscape that we're in with social media, with Twitter, like, is there some sort of personal resource that you have to just like fill your own cup and like make sure you like are not getting too drained by like the quote unquote discourse?
Yeah, I'm so rarely on social media. Mm-hmm. I think that's really what it has been for me. I think it's habit forming, and it can be habit forming in a great way if it's moving your agenda forward and it feels good and you're getting more work because you have more followers, all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to be cynical about that.
Yeah.
It's easy to be cynical about it, but I've seen it help friends of mine who maybe didn't get that credibility from somewhere else. And so you could argue that they built it themselves via social media. And I totally respect that. And I envy that. But every time I think to myself, like, oh, I should engage more so that I get more and more and more followers, something inside me like cries because I just can't live. I can't live online that way. I can't. And I don't think it's this thing about my age. I think I've always been somebody who needs to be very physically kind of present to things and not be overwhelmed and not get a headache from staring at my computer and stuff. So I have a vulnerability to electronics in that way where I'm like, oh, I can only do this for a certain period of time. And then like, I can't.
Was that always the case? Or was there a moment where you're like, I have to draw the line?
I never felt like I drew a line.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's what people are like, how do you manage to not get sucked into Instagram? I'm like, I don't know. I have so many people that I quote unquote follow who I adore on Instagram. I have no idea what their children look like. I truly don't know what they're up to unless I talk to them.
Right.
I never scroll through feed. Never.
Yeah.
I might see the first, I go on to post and then I'm out.
Yeah.
Or I go on to respond because I feel like if I post, then I want the responsibility of that engagement of being like, hey, thank you for taking the time to say you liked this picture. You're cool, or give it a little heart or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't want to just like be that I'm not an unapproachable person at all. I'm like grossly approachable. But
your bio. Grossly approachable.
I just don't start. And it's not like I have to stop myself. There is no part of me that's like, ooh, I really want to scroll through this feed. It's just not even something that comes up for
me. There are some people that just have that, like, they can in and out. And not have that like addictive relationship to social media, which is very healthy.
I guess. I mean, I think there are things I'm missing out on too, but I don't. I think I'm getting to the place in my life where you sort of acknowledge who you are and go from there. And mm-hmm. I think that would be, I would have to really mean it if I wanted to change myself in that way. And then it is like, well, what do I have time for? Becoming a totally different person in that regard or just making some other stuff or, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's super interesting. We could go down the rabbit hole of the social media conversation.
It's a hot topic.
We will take a very quick break and come right back with more Janet Varney and Lady Hawk.
Hey, everybody. This is J. Keith Van Stratton, host of Go Fact Yourself, a live game show here on the Maximum Fun Network. On Go Fact Yourself, we take the smartest people we know and make them look dumb.
Paul, by the way, how much do you know about chicken husbandry?
You gotta give him that grain.
All right.
Gotta give him that grain.
And then smart again.
What future Hall of Fame pitcher for the Cleveland Indians became the first active player to enlist?
Bob Feller.
Okay.
We've got me, co-host Helen Hong, plus celebrity guests and actual surprise experts.
All right, we have an expert on hand who can tell us for sure.
Is it Alan Avey?
Helen, who do we have tonight?
Alan Havey!
Alan Havey!
In the coming weeks, you can hear guests like Maria Bamford, Tom Bergeron, Paul F. Tompkins, Janet Varney, and Grant Imahara. Check us out on the first and third Friday of every month here on the Maximum Fun Network.
We're back. We're talking Lady Hawk. I'm Katie Walsh. We're here with Janet Varney. So I did promise Janet we would talk about some of the other could have been cast.
Yeah, the other Eric Stoltzes in the Back to the Futures.
Yes.
Great.
Huge, crazy one. Richard Donner really wanted Mick Jagger to play the bishop.
Really?
Yes, which I cannot imagine. I can imagine then that the bishop would have been a lot more like sexy and slimy. But like, can you imagine Mick Jagger with that hat on?
I mean, no. I'm like, because, you know, you see David Bowie in Labyrinth and you're like, how has that, like, nothing has ever made more sense than that somehow, even if you didn't see it coming. Mick Jagger's a bishop. I mean, it's a major wink. It's like, you know, that's really, when you're stunt casting like that, that feels so self-aware because you got to know if you're Richard Donner, you have to know that that is going to pull people out of the movie so fast. Like, it's Mick Jagger. You know, you know you're casting Mick Jagger.
Right.
You
know? And he's going to be like, you know, doing his like swivelly hip dance.
Sassy. Yeah. Yeah. It's very, very hard to imagine.
And then for the Philippe the Mouse role, which was so beautifully captured by Matthew Broderick, both Sean Penn, Fast Times.
No.
And Dustin Hoffman.
What? I just exploded the microphone. Are you kidding me?
Were considered. But, like, Dustin Hoffman was older than Rucker Hauer, like, when they were going to shoot the movie.
I mean, it doesn't say that he has to be any particular age now that I'm thinking about it. Like, it doesn't say that.
Right. But it really does have that kind of, like, you know, when he gets, like, scooped up by Navarre. Like, he needs to be younger, like, more. Like, there's the power dynamic at play.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, it's
that is nuts. We could have sat here for 3 hours and you could say like fire off some guesses
and I would never
have gotten to those two.
And I'm
never
also just imagining like Spicoli.
I know, like
hey, like I just escaped from the bishop.
Call me the mouse. What's up? It's so funny. Oh my god!
Like his blonde feathered hair.
I mean, I would have thought you would have said was like Ricky Schroeder or like, you know what I mean? I would have thought that somebody who was somewhat comparable.
Right.
But wow,
but really,
that's
when you
nuts.
Think about it, it's like it only ever could have been Matthew Broderick.
I agree. I mean, I feel that way about all three of them.
I know. When you
Kurt Russell. I mean, listen, I love Kurt Russell.
Okay, so try to imagine Kurt Russell and Sean Penn.
No.
You wouldn't have gotten the like European medieval vibes.
Yeah.
Like, Rucker Hauer. And, you know, R.I.P. Rucker Hauer.
I know.
So sad. He seems of another time.
Yeah. Like, so you can put him anywhere.
In the same way that Michelle Pfeiffer seems like an otherworldly, like, magical creature.
Yes.
Rutger Hauer seems like he's an ancient Viking.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. He really can pull that off. Which, I mean, Matthew Broderick, again, I wouldn't necessarily have thought that that would work.
Yeah, because he seems very modern.
Darling. He's darling.
Some other fun facts. Let's see. Rutger Hauer was like a very accomplished sword fighter because he was like in a show.
You said he was like obsessed with... He was in another medieval thing with Jennifer Jason Leigh was very shocking to me when I saw it too young. And I was like, what is happening? Oh, no.
That movie came out the same year. So
that doesn't surprise me.
1985 was a big year for a lot of these people.
Yeah.
Richard Donner had a little movie called The Goonies.
Mm-hmm.
Also
heard of it.
Released
heard of it.
In 1985. And Rutger Hauer was in a Paul Verhoeven medieval movie called...
Oh, that's why, because it's Verhoeven.
Yeah, it's Flesh and Blood.
With Jennifer Jason Leigh.
With Jennifer Jason Leigh.
That's a very confusing movie for a young person. It was definitely very like... Because he does play this kind of bad person who is doing very bad things, but because... I mean, he's a classic anti-hero, right? He sort of takes advantage of Jennifer Jason Leigh, but then she manages to manipulate him so that she's taken less advantage of. And then they have this sort of love affair, but like, from whence it came. You're like, chill.
You're like,
no, this is bad.
Creepy.
Yeah.
It's an interesting... Rutger Hauer is such an interesting actor. We sort of touched on it a little bit earlier, but like, he, you know, has the ability to play sort of sinister characters, and this is a straight up romantic leading role, even though he is a wolf man. But I saw a quote from him when I was looking this up that he was sort of like, he didn't really want to be a huge star. So I wonder if he kind of denied some of those like hero roles so he could like and be more of a character actor type.
I do think of him as a character actor, don't
you? Yeah, totally.
It's like, what would Blade Runner have been without him? I mean, what would have Blade Runner been without basically any of the wonderful actors in it? But trying to imagine that movie without him and like someone else being in that seminal scene where he's, you know, the tears and rain, everybody. Like that, to me, that scene is the movie in some ways.
Yeah, like we said about this movie, Blade Runner is just cast. You can't imagine anyone else in it.
Yeah. I love, that's the reason that those movies stand the test of time. Clearly, no one's heard of Lady Hawk, so it hasn't quite made it into the Blade Runner category.
The video tech staff has heard of Lady. They were, when I rented Lady Hawk from Video Tech, they were like, yeah, obviously. Like, duh.
It is three names. It's nice. It's one thing when someone's like, you've never seen blah, 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 and you're like, who's in it? And then they say three semi-obscure people. You're like, okay, well, that's, I don't necessarily, I shouldn't have necessarily. But when you hear those three names together, you're like, huh.
Yeah.
I know I haven't seen it or heard of it.
It's a great combo.
Yeah. Unexpected combo.
So have you ever wanted, I mean, we're talking about this now, but like, you know, do a medieval period piece. They don't make the movies like this anymore.
I would. I mean, I definitely would. I did. I've worn sort of Shakespearean classic clothes once in my life, which was when I did The Merry Wives of Windsor when I was in college. Mm-hmm. And they are heavy as hell. Mm-hmm. It was like a very heavy, multi-layered velvet, like with the sort of bustier and everything, the corset and all of that. I do not envy. I mean, Dangerous Liaisons is a great movie to show off just how often women fainted. Yes. Like, they do not shy away from that. Women are constantly having to get some air or pass out on a couch, and that is how it was.
Like, it's
you
too damn
could
hot.
Not breathe. You were crushing your lungs, and everything was heavy and hot, and you couldn't breathe. And I'm sure everyone stunk.
I know.
Which
I know.
Is fine, but you never think about that when you're watching things like that.
At least Michelle had some garments that breathed a little bit.
Yeah, she got to. She really. It was. You're right. There's a sort of little boyish, androgyny to it.
I know.
Swimming in her cloaks.
I love all her costumes.
Me too.
I think it was an Italian costume director. I think she makes a little cameo in the film too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
I wonder if she was the bird when they have the. Because there's a woman dancing with the bishop at the beginning.
I think that's her. Yeah.
It would make sense. Yeah. She was wearing a beautiful robe that had wings on it.
Yeah, that's her.
Yeah, that's cool.
Well. Janet Varney, thank you so much for talking
about Lady Hawk. Thank you for giving me a reason to rewatch it and talk about it. It was so much fun.
Guys, you got to see Lady Hawk. Go listen to the score, listen to some Alan Parsons projects, some Kate Bush, and just get into your medieval fantasy.
That's right. Don't be afraid because love conquers all.
Yeah. And listen to Janet's podcast, Voyage to the Stars, the JV Club.
Awesome.
Anything else?
No, I mean, just come up to Sketchfest. There's a ton of Max Fun shows that are going to be up there per usual. We got Judge John Hodgman and Jordan Jesse Go and a bunch that I'm forgetting because we have like 300 shows. So, but we love,
remember all of them right now.
Remember all
them.
Of them. But lots of great opportunities to
and
come and see comedy
so
in San Francisco.
Soon. Are you guys
January 9th through 26th?
In the thick of planning right now?
Very much in the thick. Lots of editing of the program, of the like 56 page program.
Are you going to do your podcast there?
I'm not. I usually do like a year, then I take a year off, take a year off.
I see.
So this was a year where I felt like there was so much going on that I should probably do, that I should skip.
Is this the 20th anniversary?
Almost.
Almost.
19th.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
Well.
The one before 20. That's how we think of it.
All right. Thank you so much, Janet.
Thanks,
this was such a treat.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters with me, Katie Walsh. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of MaximumFun.org.
I was told to bring you this bird.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.